The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, folks. I have the pleasure to be joined by Rupert Lowe, independent MP for Great Yarmouth, husband, father, business owner, grandfather, in fact, and social media firebrand.
Well, I think that's probably a bit flattering, Carl. I, again, it's irony, really. I owe my social media representation to Nigel Farage, because when I got so frustrated with Theresa May that, as you probably know, I stood for the referendum party, I did a lot against the Maastricht Treaty. I then did a lot of business of Sterling. I did a lot for Vote Leave. And when I came forward to stand for the Brexit Party, because our establishment, as usual, were making a complete cock of it, I decided that I should go and see Nigel, which I did. And basically, he said to me, if you want to stand, and I'd like you to stand, you have to have an X account, what was a Twitter account in those days. So I said, well, I can't believe that anybody wants to read the rubbish that I might put out. But if you insist, if that's part of the deal, then I'll set one up. So hence, I'm now active on social media, not just on X. I mean, we found other platforms, Facebook locally in Great Yarmouth, Facebook nationally, LinkedIn incredibly powerful. And I think those people, the Luddites who say social media is a bad thing and therefore don't use it, are missing a big trick. And if anything, my own view is it's an agent for freedom. Because if you have enough people following you on social media, then any injustices that you suffer can be made public. And I think that's a shield to protect at least some of this nonsense, which would protect you one against it. This sort of lawfare, which I think the Western states are now employing against their honest, decent, taxpaying citizens.
I completely agree. And it's a wonderful thing to have someone like Elon Musk in control of one of the most important social media platforms, because Elon has made it very clear that he also views them as a tool for freedom. And he's quite uncompromising on that, actually.
Well, he was a breath of fresh air when he took it over in credit terms. It was a huge takeover. Arguably, he overpaid for it. But I think, like a lot of things he does, and I do think he's probably the world's most successful entrepreneur, so I give him credit for that. Clearly, we've seen him cut out a load of overhead. A lot of that was arguably sort of editing people's posts and using all sorts of algorithms to dumb people down. He is, like you and I, a proponent of completely unfettered free speech, which, as we know, is part of our constitution, our unwritten constitution, and it's embedded in the 1689 Bill of Rights. So I think we tread off that path at our own peril. And if we do disrespect that Protestant ethic, which is embedded into the Bill of Rights, then we will be taking a very retrograde step.
Couldn't agree more. What I was going to lead this conversation with is, I was going to ask you to give me a general lay of the political landscape in Britain from your point of view. Who do you think is doing well? Who do you think is doing poorly? And what do you think the future holds? And what do we need?
Well, Labour, Carl, I call it their landslip election victory because it wasn't a landslide. Mm. It was they won a big majority on a very, very small percentage of the vote. So in my view, that's a landslip, not a landslide. And I think I want to be in Parliament later because I've got this horrible feeling that when we see the details of what they've done with this European treaty that they've now rekindled, despite the fact that 17.4 million people voted to leave the EU and take back our own sovereignty, I suspect they're going to pursue what they've always wanted to pursue, which is this sort of post-war socialist European dream. Mm. So they've surrendered the Chagos Islands, and I see this morning Mauritius is now talking not only to China but also to Russia. It's the most bizarre piece of statesmanship I've ever seen in my life. I think maybe it's Starmer, Hermer, and Lammy indulging their sort of view that Britain is a sort of racist post-colonial nation, which actually, when actual fact, Britain did a hell of a lot of good during its colonial period. Obviously, some bad, but you know that comes with the territory.
I think I'm fairly representative of most people's opinion of the British Empire. I generally think it was basically a good thing.
And, it was a good thing, and look at India's legal system. Look at a lot of the structures we put in place. It's an interesting one. This, and I don't know if you've looked at this, but my own personal theory, and not everybody agrees with this, is that I am the product. Even I'm called a toff and all that sort of stuff by Saints supporters and by other people. I'm actually not a toff. I'm a provincial boy, and I've just given you a book on our family business. It's been 100 years. But I actually think the public schools got a lot to be blamed for. And this is my own personal theory. And if ever you read, there's a man called Corelli Barnett who's written some extremely good books on why the public school and the sort of religious movement, really, of the sort of 1850s, which is when a lot of them were formed, is responsible not only for creating people to administer the empire, which they did very honestly, it also weakened. It weakened us because after Waterloo in 1815, we had the opportunity, if we'd wanted to take over Europe. We didn't do that. We just wanted to trade with Europe. So trade was the driver for Britain. It always has been. We're a maritime nation. So I think in terms of, you know, post-war, post sort of Waterloo Britain, the public schools probably to blame for a lot of the problems, not only products like myself, but also people who ultimately are imbued with a view that there is a right and there is a wrong. And that's, I think, the basis of the British Empire, which, with a few exceptions, was a very good thing for a lot of people. So I don't think we should feel in any way ashamed of what we've done. I think we should feel proud of it, and I think we should feel very proud of our history.
Oh, I agree. And just a quick thing there. It's remarkable how ignorant people are of the world prior to the British Empire. Just tremendous levels of suffering, slavery, and other highly ignoble practices just all over the world.
Well, as you know, Wilberforce, that was a he was an Englishman, and he ultimately, along with the Royal Navy, fun enough, we enforced the anti-slavery movement. And, you know, I think probably the most interesting part of our history was a period when we had the Civil War, but we had tremendous sort of evolution of Britain as a principled democracy, where you had incredibly enlightened people doing very enlightened things, and you got huge amounts of change here, which I think often is not discussed properly and not covered probably in the history books either. Mm. So, you know, we did have wars, we did have some unpleasantness, but in the end, that tends to be a feature of human history. So conflict is a good thing. And I would argue that a lot of the power of Europe, a lot of the strength of Europe was from the conflicts that took place between the nation states.
And preaching to the choir.
Before I go on with your question about political parties, let's just talk about nation states, because competing nation states were the genesis, in my view, of Europe's preeminence for a very long period of time. It may be that we're about to surrender that because of our sort of rotten political system, which is now prevailing. But I've never understood why anyone thought that a sort of collection of cooperating nation states isn't the best form of government for everybody. And that appears to be not what the globalists want, and they're doing their very best to ensure that doesn't happen. So going back to the political situation, so Labour, I think, are, in my view, a bunch of jokers. Would I put Keir Starmer, David Lammy, Rachel Reeves, and a collection of people with no business experience in charge of negotiating on behalf of the British people? No, I definitely wouldn't. Of 26 of them, I think three of them have got what I would call very questionable business experience. So I watch in sort of absolute shock as they appear to think the Europeans have a stronger negotiating position than us, when in reality, we are the ones who voted to leave. We are the ones who've got the arms, we've got the technology, we've got the structures which Europe needs. Equally, we have a massive trade deficit with Europe. And if you have a trade deficit, that gives you the negotiating power, because you don't have to trade with Europe. You can actually buy your oranges and a lot of your products that we used to be forced to buy from Spain or other parts of the European Union. We can buy them from other parts of the world far cheaper. We can equally have a say in how they're produced and what quality we want out of those products. And, you know, after many years in the EU, our fishing industry is destroyed. My constituency, Great Yarmouth, you used to be able to walk across the port there on fishing boats. There's now one left. So there are no, you know, the bloaters there no longer. The herring industry is no longer there. They used to process herring. That's all gone. Most of our fish is now processed in Holland. Most of our food is processed in Europe because they bought up. We have a much more open economy than them, so a lot of our businesses got bought up, and a lot of our jobs got exported to the continent. So look, I think with the right leadership, this country, we've got the best people. We just haven't got the best leaders. So talking Labour, no, that for me, they are rank amateurs. There are a lot of them who are too young to even know which way is up. They're new MPs. I think we're beginning to see a bit of sort of revolt from the rural constituencies, because having done over the farmers and the small businesses and tried to break the backbone of Britain, some of them are beginning to realise that they're not going to be re-elected next time. So you're seeing the first stirrings of a bit of a frisson there. But you know, to give you an example, when I was arguing with a man called Daniel Zeichner, who runs DEFRA, I've clashed with him and Steve Reed over the fact that both of them said that there would be no APR on farmland if they won the election. And shortly after the election, they banged APR onto farmland, as well as BPR onto small family businesses. So I went to see Mr. Zeichner, and in his office, and we had 20 minutes talking about why it was a bad thing and breaking the backbone of Britain's farmers and small businesses was a thoroughly bad idea.
Sorry, I have to.
But I've got to tell you this. So he looks me in the eye, yeah. Carl, and he says, "I've got to stop you there, Rupert," he said. "I think that very often the public sector is more efficient than the private sector." That's not a joke, Carl. That is what he said.
Based
to me.
On what evidence?
At which point I closed my file and I stood up and I said, "In that case, Daniel, I'm wasting my time," and I walked out. So,
oh my God,
these people are driven. They're driven not by logic. They're driven by some sort of ideological crusade that they think they need to carry out. Mm. And whatever they say, I have a saying: watch what the hands are doing, not what the mouth is saying. Just watch what the hands are doing everywhere. Mm. What they're trying to do is remove the power of the individual and impose the power of the state. Mm. We've already got too much state. We need the individual to be cut free. We need the brambles to be cut back, the light to come in, and we need to cut the size of the state and empower those people who are going to take risk and drive our economy. As well as, you know, I always think human relationships are far better. You know, you and I having a relationship rather than the state trying to impose some sort of relationship between people, which never works.
I mean, these are all things that have been self-evident conventional wisdom for decades until right now. until now when everything, I mean, for example, you having to explain why actually breaking the back of the farmers is a bad thing for Britain. Why should you have to explain that? That should be so self-evident.
Well, they see it, I think, as an elitist part of Britain, but what they don't are none of them farm, and I actually do. It's my passion. I've always wanted to farm, but for various reasons, in the end, largely because my father had five wives, and I didn't get on with some of my stepmothers, so I ended up having to go and make my own way, and ended up in the city, and then I've actually got my own farm now, which I've bought. And it's my passion, and you know, when I get filled with bullet holes from whether it's the establishment, whether it's my colleagues at Reform, whoever, the sanity returns when I walk my crops and I look at things growing and I think to myself, there's no way that I can actually change nature. Nature is what it is. You have to respect it. You have to be humble. You have to work with it. You can't work against it. And this is, I think, where man's gone so wrong now. And this is where I think, in answer to your question about the political parties, there's a lot of very lightweight people who are there, as we know, because Blair and Cameron selected people on quotas, not on merit. And there's an arrogance, there's an underlying arrogance rather than a humility. And people think they can control everything, which they will learn that they can't. They can't, they simply can't. They think they can. Mm-hmm. And the latest fad, obviously, is trying to live forever and, you know, all the things that the modern man or woman thinks that she can achieve. And the arrogance that comes with it is quite incredible. But let's move on to the Tories. So the Tories, I think, you know, I get on very well with the Tories. I think there are some very good young Tories. I think they are Tory. And you know, there's a difference between being conservative and being a Tory, as you and I know. Yes. A lot of other people probably don't know that, but I think we know that.
I think the public's becoming well aware that the Conservatives are actually not conservative.
No, they're Lib Dems. There's about 70 Lib Dem Tories. So that is in itself an oxymoron, but that's what they are. So I think there is some light within the Tory party. But the problem is we've had a series of very weak leaders who have brought in people in their own image rather than the people who should have been brought in. And reformed, I think the Tory party is still, as it was when Maggie Thatcher reformed it after, you know, too much socialism, which, as you know, ended in Britain being the laughing stock of the world, having to go to the IMF, beer and sandwiches in number 10.
My father...
For the unions.
All through my youth, my father would regale me with tales of how they would have the electricity would go out during the middle of the week, or the rubbish would be...
When I was at school, we used to have prep boards and we had candles on the prep board because electricity went out when you needed it to study.
Yes.
So look, I mean, the miners' strikes, we had obviously, it was a shocking period. And after the 60s, which I think was a wonderful period, and in some ways that was the sort of release post-war. But then we got the socialism and we got, you know, the death of Britain, really, of enterprise, which is what happens when you get collectivism. So, and there's always been a battle, in my view, between collectivism and individualism. I'm firmly in the individual camp. I loathe collectivism. I think collectivism should be fought at every turn. So it hides all sorts of sins and weaknesses. And you only have to look at what happened. The communists lasted, what, 1.5 generations? Mm. And when the wall finally came down, there was nothing there.
Yeah.
And I can remember that. That was great. So we don't seem to learn from that. And we are getting to the stage now where, you know, we have got too much collectivism. Why would you take risk if you decide something's a good idea and you invest and you make money, the state takes it all off you. But if you lose money because you're wrong, and that's the essence of an entrepreneur, is to lubricate the system, you still have to write the check. And now it's getting more and more difficult to offset those losses against other income streams. So what do people do? The answer is nothing, which is what happened under communism. So nobody creates enterprise. Nobody employs other people. Mm. Nobody bothers to do anything other than, if they're rich, sit on their backside and enjoy the sort of, whether it's the benefits of their labors or their forebears is another matter. But the Tories, so I think there are some good things in the Tories, but I want to answer your question on this. But I think they've got a long way to go. I think head office is a problem. I think that
CCHQ's a problem.
The Lib Dem Tory MPs are a problem. Really? And I think the jury's still very much out on whether they've picked the right leader. And I have nothing against Kemi. I think she's a nice lady, but has she covered herself in glory at the dispatch box? Probably not. Is she going to be able to do what is necessary for the Tory party? I think it's possible that she will find it difficult.
So I have to ask the question that is hanging in the air. Are you going to join the Conservative Party?
Well, I think if I wanted to, I could. But I don't think it would be right to do that at the moment. As I say, I think a reformed Tory party would be interesting. But I don't see how they can get themselves out of their current malaise. And let's face it, they did have quite a long play with the toy set, not least Boris with an 80-seat majority who did the square root of nothing.
If he'd done nothing, things would be better.
Indeed, it seemed to me at the latter part of his sort of tenure that actually it was his wife running the country rather than him. It was her policies that seemed to be coming through rather than his. And if you look at what Boris wrote, you know, between 2000 and 2015, he wrote some great stuff.
He did.
Unfortunately, he couldn't deliver it.
Well, this is the question about Boris. Was he sincere or was he just saying what people wanted to hear? And like you say, you know, you can say whatever you like, but you've got to watch what the hands are doing. And the hands were very, very just an open betrayal, just plunging daggers into
the back. I think the answer is the mouth said a lot, but we didn't see much from the hands, Carl. I think
the main issue is the immigration.
Extraordinary. Legal immigration.
Yeah, 100%, because the illegal immigration is always used as a bit of a smokescreen by the Conservatives in particular. But you brought them in and put them in hotels, so don't talk to me about the illegals. But it's the legals that are the issue. I mean, we see it in Swindon High Street now. There's just people from just all over the world sat around drinking coffee, and I'm paying for the privilege.
Yep.
And this is all thanks to Boris Johnson. So thanks, Boris.
So that's the Tories, you know, they need to reform, basically. Obviously, the Lib Dems, I when all this,
you're not going to join the Lib Dems.
Well, when all this nonsense happened, I Daisy Cooper threw her arms around me and said, "Was I okay?" And I sort of, you know, pinched myself and thought, because I'm often up against her on the different side of the equation. But by the way, I like political debate.
Yeah, me
you
too.
You know, I mean, Wedgie Benn was one of my heroes. I don't mind people who say what they think if it disagrees with me, but as long as they're honest about it, unlike Keir Starmer, unlike most of the Labour front bench. Anyway, she threw her arms around me and said, "What are you okay?" Because I think everybody in Parliament could see that what reform did to me was vile, unfair, and just totally unjust. Mm. So despite the fact that, you know, the accusations they made against me, you know, the fact that I had early onset dementia and I was showing signs of losing my temper, and you know that I was bullying people, which is complete nonsense, and that, you know, I made threats which I didn't. So at the end of the day, she came up to me, and I did say to her, "Well, I'm okay, Daisy, but lesser men might be in the Priory by now." So anyway, we've carried on, and I think there is now some light there. But the Lib Dems, I find it hard to take them seriously, to be honest.
Oh, really?
Very hard.
Laugh, but I watched Ed Davies' campaigns. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I'd like to go to Alton Towers with him, but I don't really want him running the country.
What, falling off surfboards in Windermere
it was? He looks like a fun guy, doesn't he? You know, but like I said, I don't really want them in charge of the country.
No.
So they're not appealing to you then, the Liberal Democrats?
No, and the Greens, I simply can't take them seriously. But, you know, so...
What, a communist Islamic alliance? I'm not in favour of those either.
So that's a quick roundup. But, yeah. I mean, the essence of Parliament is that we have sort of a group of people who don't represent what I think should be represented in Parliament. It's not the cutting edge of Britain. It's a hollowed out, rather average group of people who, you know, those fish that sort of swim around like this and they swim around like this and they swim around. I think it's a bit like that.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you something else about Parliament, which I think is interesting, which in my short tenure there is it's supposed to be, under the 1689 Bill of Rights, an elected MP is supposed to be an incredibly powerful person. And the staff are supposed to support the MPs. The MPs are supposed to, from the MPs are drawn the cabinet ministers who are then supposed to hold the civil service to account. Mm-hmm. But if you get this very weak gene pool in Parliament, first of all, the ministers don't hold the civil service to account, which is what has happened. So ultimately, the permanent secretaries are running the country and they're unelected. And they're not being held to account by the people who are elected, who are on the front bench, who should be. That's their job, a bit like a chairman holding a board to account. Mm. But equally, and we saw this with Dominic Raab, and that's why I think Reform using this lawfare against me, this accusation of this false accusation of bullying in my office and things like that, you know. The staff in Parliament now are arguably more powerful than the MPs. They have the best offices at any sort of form of holding to account. They shout foul or bully or some other sort of accusation. There is, as a result of the MP's expenses scandal, there's a man called Daniel Greenberg, who is the Parliamentary Commissioner on Standards. So most of the people live in fear of this fellow, who's got an absolutely wonderful office in Parliament. Not like what I call the mole hole, which has got no light, and one of which has got a door. But the penalty is I've got scaffolding in my office because the roof is need to be propped up. So my office is sort of cut by about 30% because I've got a large piece of scaffolding with, you know, that foam around it to make sure nobody hurts themselves on it, thanks to health and safety.
Yeah.
So look, Parliament probably needs a big shake up itself. It probably needs to understand that the elected MPs are the representatives of the people. They should be omnipotent. They should be powerful. They should not be frightened of saying what they think, of doing what they think, of behaving in a way which obviously has to be correct. But they should be forceful, strong, powerful leaders who represent their area. And that was the essence of Parliament. I think you had, you know, me and my constituent, you and your constituency, and then you had an active debate on what was the best interests of your constituency and the country. Mm. And you hoped you were able to align all those and then make decisions for the British people. And
This is a much more sort of Burkean approach to politics.
Of course.
Yeah.
And, you know, Lord Salisbury, you know, people like that, they, I think, were powerful, but their interests aligned with the interests of the British people, and we got some great decisions.
Mm.
Today, Keir Starmer, human rights lawyer, he's pork-barreled living on the back of what I would call a sort of legal system which has gone very badly wrong. Is he the right man to be leading the country? Is he the right man to be defending our borders? Is he the right man to be protecting the remnants of what is in Britain's interests? I doubt it.
Very few people would doubt that either. So what do you think Britain actually needs at this point? What is required to set the ship of state right?
I'll tell you what I say to my constituents, Carl. And I'm 67. I give my parliamentary salary to charity just to show I'm not in this for personal advantage. In fact, my wife would quite like it if I hadn't done what I'm doing, because we would be living a far more civilized life, and probably we could see our days out. And as I've been doing this weekend, grow my vegetables, which I've been posting about on my ex account. You've seen my tomatoes; they look quite.
I have. They look very nice.
So I say to people, you can't expect whoever you elect, you can't just sit back and expect them to do it all. So I say to people in my constituency and everybody I bump into, don't rely totally on the people who are leading. Mm. They can lead, but if they get filled with holes by a malign establishment, challenge. You've got to challenge. So challenge in your own way. So your local council is supposed to serve you. Mm-hmm. Not you serve them. They're not supposed to be using the powers that a local authority has to bully their constituents, which is what's happening.
So what's happening in Oxford.
If they're not mending your potholes correctly, write them a rude letter. Ring them up. Make them understand that you're not going to accept it. Equally, if you see things happening you don't like, write to your MP. Start to stand up. If you get petty bureaucracy telling you how to live your life, no, No, stand up to them. Because, you know, if you stand up to a bully, they stop bullying. But if you yield to that bullying, which is what a very decent, civilized British public tend to do, it encourages them. So I say, don't just accept the status quo. If you don't agree with it, say so. And I'm hoping people will start to be more bloody-minded, more difficult, and demand some value for the local taxes they pay, for the national taxes they pay. I don't know about you, but I seem to pay more and more tax.
Don't get me started on taxes.
I have HMRC treating me as if I'm a tax evader most of the time. I get, and again, this is another thing that the state does, is it weaponizes the system against people who speak up. So I get a tax investigation most years. I call it vilification, unfair vilification of an honest taxpayer. So far, I mean, and you and I know that the tax code is 21,500 pages long. Plays Hong Kong's tax code 500 pages long. So it's like everything in Britain today. There are so many rules, so many regulations, so much licensing, so much oppression of the people that even if you're trying your very best, and I used to be able to do my tax return myself, I no longer can. I have to pay an accountant vast sums of money because they have the algorithms to try and navigate all these various rules, regulations, laws, mostly that are designed to be contradictory, so that if you do fall out with the establishment, there's always some hook with which they can attack you and then hold you up as a tax evader. Well, so far, I've avoided that each year. We get one. It costs money. I am insured most of the time while I can still get insurance. But so these are the things. This is the lawfare that's being used against people who question the system. But if we all do it, they can't do it against everybody. So I say, let's become a little more difficult. That's what I think the honest British taxpaying public should do. And let's start objecting to the fact that our taxes are being wasted. And I have this view that it's the state that's corrupt now. Because if they collect tax from you and I, they have a duty to spend it properly, wisely, sensibly, in our interests, not wasting it on vanity projects like, you know, how much have they wasted on HS2? How much does the DWP waste? I mean, the DWP, the more I ask questions to get answers back, is the most inefficient part of the British state.
It's depressing.
Handing out money like confetti, Carl, to all and sundry.
I hate hearing about it. So I can't help but notice that there's a kind of, you speak about being shot through with bullet holes, but I watched your interview with Emily Maitlis the other day, and I can't help but notice that you seem to be kind of enjoying yourself in that interview while she was throwing slings and arrows at you. And even now you're saying, I think we should be a bit more difficult. You've got a cheeky smile on your face. Is it something you actually hate doing, or is it kind of fun?
Well, I think I blame the Dragon School. I went to a school called the Dragon School in Oxford, which is where you had boys who and girls in my day. Shockingly, do you know what we used to call them, Carl?
No,
they were called hags. You wouldn't dare call them that now.
And if you
got kissed at the Dragon School by a girl, you got hag pong.
Oh, really?
It was shocking. Anyway, so you wouldn't dare do that now. But anyway, there were. I can remember their names now. So at the Dragon, you were taught to challenge authority. So I think a lot of dragons challenge authority. It was a great school. Is it as great as it was? I mean, I'll give you an example. It's gone a bit woke. So I was in a house there called Gunga Din. And you know,
from
Gunga Din was Mr. Kipling.
Yes.
The Dragon changed the name of Gunga Din to Dragon House on the basis that Rudyard Kipling was a colonial racist. I don't know, but he never was.
No, he was a very reasonable man.
I think Gunga Din was considered to be a very good man in his book, from what I remember.
It's literally the line he uses. You're a better man than I, Gunga
Correct.
Din.
Correct. So they changed the name. So we cancelled our standing orders to the Dragon School. So who knows? Maybe they'll change back to what they used to be. But they did used to post-war. And I think post-war people loved their freedom. They loved the fact we'd fought two world wars and that they respected.
And they fought for the freedom.
A lot of people who taught us had fought for freedom. One of them had served on the wretched, Japanese railway line.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He was called Parr Denison Smith. And wonderful man. And I think there were a generation of people who did respect individualism. They did respect freedom. They did respect freedom of speech. And they imbued their pupils with that. So I think I was very fortunate. My father said he was brought up in the best period of British history, and he may have been right. He sadly died in November 22, having been born in 1932. And like your father, he was actually in the Air Force during his national service.
Right, right.
So do I enjoy it? Look, I enjoy a mischievous challenge. I have to tell you that I don't run my businesses as a dictator. I run them because I'm not that clever, and I like to hire people who are cleverer than me, which is not very difficult.
Mm.
And then I find they run properly. But if I try and hire people who are less able than me, they don't run at all. So that's the essence of what I believe. And I've done many things. I've traveled widely. And during my young life, I think Britain was the best place in the world to live.
Mm.
I'm not sure I could say that about it now. And what we've got to do, all of us, before 29, when I think if we don't get change, the country will self-immolate. I think we've all got to fight for what we believe in. And I know you believe in it. I know there's a lot of people out there who still believe in it. But it's going to be a fight, because the malign forces that don't agree with us have undermined our schools. They have undermined a lot of our institutions. And not least Parliament, as I just said, I don't think Parliament's as functional as it used to be. And our unwritten constitution has always been open to abuse. So it's like, I think it was Maggie who said, you know, freedom is a very fragile commodity. And if you don't fight for it, you very quickly lose it.
Mm.
So I think everybody's got to fight for it themselves. I don't believe in this concept of a dictatorial leader delivering freedom. That's a sort of, that again is another oxymoron.
Well,
so
it's a very European view of freedom, isn't it?
Don't talk to me about Europe. I mean, I love Europe. I love going there. My wife and I love walking in Italy. We love walking the Via Francigena. We love the food in Italy. We love the Italian people, but they've been destroyed by the euro, as have many of the other proud independent nations with their own identity.
I spent my teenage years growing up in Germany on a British camp. And you'd go back and forth. And I had lots of German friends. And the thing that really I just came away with was, I never want to be governed by Germans. They just think differently to us. They're very much more rules focused. And they're very much not the sort of people who believe in the kind of individual liberty that the English believe in.
Exactly. And the French, the best evening I ever had at my club was when David Starkey gave a speech about our relationship with the French. And
I
he opened
David
with
Starkey.
The French are our enemy. Why do we try and suggest otherwise? So I think we have to sup with a long spoon with the French. And I think you only have to look I think they're bust. And I think they are obviously cocksure. They're very different to us. And look, render unto Europe what is Europe's, but let's not be governed by this European sort of concept of life, which, as you know, I mean, Napoleon was the first one to try and impose an EC on us, based in Paris with a French franc, and you know, with his sort of idea of a European Union being one based on conquest, which is, as I just said, not something we've ever tried to do. We could have done it, but we never have. We want to trade freely. We respect other people's sovereignty. But when I was in the European Parliament, I could see it, you know, and I think ultimately, Carl, Germany doesn't trust France. France doesn't just trust Germany. And the reason for the EU is to stop the two of them getting at each other's throats again, which is usually the genesis of most of the troubles in Europe.
So moving back to Britain very quickly, it seems that it seems to me that Tony Blair and the New Labour project was an attempt to Europeanize Britain. By installing, as you described it, the unaccountable bureaucracy and allowing the politicians to essentially offload responsibility to the bureaucrats, the quangocracy, whatever you want to call it. Is it your intention to do what you can to remove these things from power?
Well, Tony Blair, as you know, I discount John Major as a sort of blip. He should never have won that 92 election with his soapbox. And we would have had Neil Kinnock, and probably that would have been the end of socialism. That could have been it.
Mm.
I don't know if you remember that rally where they were playing loud music, thinking they had it in the bag. And somehow John Major won it by 15 seats, which he should never have done. I think it was 15 seats from them.
I was a bit young, to be honest.
So let's really ignore Major. Yeah. But I mean, ultimately, Tony Blair, the genesis of most of our problems, you can lay at the door of Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, Peter Mandelson, Alistair Campbell, and Derry Irvine. And then Cameron, for some extraordinary reason, seemed to approve of what they did. So he tried to do a bit more himself, you know, with the Bribery Act and various other things. So he was, in my view, a huge disappointment, as was Osborne. But Tony Blair's the genesis with all these, as you say, these laws and rules and regulations, which I think distorted the British Constitution. And as you say, created the quangos, the unelected bureaucrats who are still funded by the British taxpayer, who have complicated our law. Mm. Arguably, what they did with the Supreme Court undermined the basis of English justice. And I'm, you know, English justice now is probably needs to be reformed again. As you probably know, he played a big part in devolution, which I think was all part of the cunning plan of the European Union to destroy the proudest sovereign nation in Europe, which was us. So if you can create, I think they created us into five regions, I think I'm right in saying, but they also devolved power, you know, with the Scottish Parliament and the Senate. And they were trying to sort of at every point disempower Westminster. That was part of their plan. And Blair, another lawyer, not particularly good lawyer, I don't think.
That's what I've heard.
But he was a lawyer.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, he's a likely lad. You know, you've got to give him credit for the fact that he is a hugely effective salesman.
He's a brilliant politician.
I think he's a brilliant politician. He was very, very believable. And, you know, a lot of people who you would never have expected to vote Labour, in 97, they did vote Labour.
Mm-hmm.
Hence, we got Tony Blair in tears on the door of Downing Street, playing "Things Can Only Get Better" or whatever they were playing at the time, and everybody felt good. And then we got Cool Britannia and all the other rubbish. But so I lay a lot of the issues at their door, and I think if we by 29, if what I call the common sense wing of Britain can establish itself and we can win an election under the right leadership, we need to start with a Great Repeal Act, which has to repeal a lot of this malign legislation.
Can you give me a list of things you'd
Well, do? Things like, I mean, on my list, probably the Race Relations Act has to go. Probably the 97 Human Rights Act, which embeds within the ECHR.
Yep.
Very definitely the Equality Act, which has to go. As I mentioned, the Bribery Act, the Supreme Court needs to be sorted out. Mm-hmm. But I think we need a list of, we need a plan now to repeal.
I happen to have a ready plan. We need to get rid of the Supreme Court. We need to get rid of the devolved assemblies.
Sounds like we're in rude agreement.
Oh, we are. The Communications Act.
I'm a devolution. Nigel gave me a rocket because I gave a speech at the at the summer rally last September, where he told me I spoke for too long, so I spoke for 23 minutes. But I did offer to show him my speech. He said he never writes one. Well, I write my speeches because I like a bit of history and a few quotes in it. And I did say, my view would be, let's reverse devolution. Yeah. Let's return
the
power
whole
to
thing
Westminster.
Has to be changed.
Let's be what we should be, which is one country. So I do think the strength of this country is as the act of union. Mm-hmm. We are one nation and we should behave as one nation. And, you know, the Brexit deal through the Northern Ireland Protocol and then latterly the Windsor Agreement actually has, if you like, carved out a piece of Britain.
Yep.
And we know why it was done. It was done because Michel Barnier thought he'd keep a hook on board our ship. Worst case, they get a united Ireland. Best case, they hook us back into the EU. We all know what the game was. But unfortunately, Carl, the bureaucrats negotiating Brexit, which they'd been told to do by the British electorate, didn't believe in what they were doing. So they were doing their best to frustrate the instructions of the 17.4 million people who voted to take back our sovereignty.
See, this is one of the major points that's always frustrated me about Brexit. And you see people arguing against the concept of Brexit on the consequences of anti-Brexiteers running the show. So, I mean, for example, I was I was pointing out to people, well, Ireland has a corporate tax of 12.5%. We have 25%. And that can't be accidental. There's exactly half of us.
Well, let me tell you what happened there, as you probably know. So Ireland was, it basically had a massive property boom and then a bust. So again, my view of it is that Ireland, despite all these so-called rules and laws and regulations, I mean, it's a bit like sort of France going into the EU and hiding a lot of their deficits through, I think it was French Telecom Pension Fund or something. But anyway, Ireland needed to be rebuilt. So how did they rebuild Ireland? I'll tell you how they did it. They set up a tax arbitrage. So they allowed Ireland to have the lowest rate of corporation tax in the EU. Mm. And guess what happened? Everybody based themselves in Ireland.
Oh, I know.
And Ireland got rich again, which it is now.
Yeah. So why aren't we doing the same thing?
So, well, this is part of my issue with Nigel. I thought we should have a plan. We should have policies. We should tell people what we were going to do.
We should have
a shadow cabinet. Yeah. This is the genesis of the issues between us.
Yes.
I told him, and I think I played a part with him and with the other reform people. And it's not just Nigel or me or anybody. It's a whole group of like-minded people who believe in what we were trying to achieve. But we need a plan, and I wanted the lowest corporation tax in Europe, which would have been 12.5%, as you quite rightly say. Then you'll get capital formation in the UK. You'll get people coming to set up businesses here.
See, I'm not an economist, but this
is
just very straightforward.
Why wouldn't we do that? Why would we charge our students so much for their student debt? Why do we encourage them to go and do these degrees which qualify them for nothing? And when you look at the book, you know, we have a big apprenticeship scheme. Yeah. Why aren't we training people for a career that's actually going to give them a life skill that they can always fall back on? I mean, would you rather learn to be a plumber or an electrician or some other, or an engineer, something real? Or would you rather go and do a degree in humanities or some other?
Well, if it helps, I actually did do a degree
from
in humanities.
What did you? I didn't know.
I did
from
philosophy.
What might have been a poly in the old days now call themselves a university.
Yeah, I did recently, actually, a philosophy degree at Birkbeck.
I wasn't having a go at you, Carl.
No, I know, but I'm not the normal case.
Do you use what you learn?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, every day here. it's been incredibly useful, but I'm not the normal case. Most people aren't going to follow the trajectory I've followed. No. I've kind of stumbled into it by accident, to be honest. So this was never a plan for me. It just happens to have fortuitously come about. But I completely agree with you. There's, for some reason, I remember this when I was young and first went to university.
There are many worse ones than humanities. I picked a bad example, Carl.
You did, I think, actually. But there's always been, since the Blair era, there's been a general animus against practical education in apprenticeships and any trade education. And I find this to be abominable because, you know, my family's working class and most of them are in trades and they're doing very well. And why would we not want to project this forward? Because most people aren't actually very academic. Most people are just normal.
Frankly. Well, I'm full of praise because we've got electrical, mechanical and data contracting businesses, and I'm full of praise for people. What they do is incredibly complex. It's very, very skilled. And arguably, they are not rewarded sufficiently, in my view, for the skill set they've got, which we will always need. Whereas the people sitting doing theoretical jobs involving the law or other professions, which again comes back to the public school, which we were talking about, because public schools taught you that trade was bad.
Yeah.
And the professions are good. So hence, we have a country that tends to think that way because that's what people were taught. And I don't agree with that. I think, you know, we've got people who've worked for us all their lives who came through as apprentices. And I'm full of praise for their skill set. They're unbelievably skilled. Mm. And, you know, look at the building projects now. Look at the complexity of them. Look at the mathematics, the engineering. Look at all the skills that need to go into building the channel tunnel or HS2, whatever. These big projects, the seven bridge or whatever it is, hugely skilled. So, and I think our society doesn't value that sufficiently. So I encourage people, don't go and do some degree that's not going to be of any good to you longer term. go and do an apprenticeship. We call it now, it's not an apprenticeship, we call it the academy, and we actually try and train people. A bit like when I was at Southampton Football Club, that was the essence of the academy there, is we had to bring in people with football talent, but you also have to set them up for the possibility that they may not make it in football, and therefore they need to make it in life.
Mm.
If you set yourself up to make it one thing and you don't, you then need to be set up. You need a safety net.
Yes.
So look, again, these apprenticeship schemes, there's the apprenticeship levy now, and there's so much wrong with accessing that money. Like all government schemes, they talk about it in Parliament, say what a wonderful idea it is, but actually, number one, they forget about it a week later, and number two, it's virtually impossible to access a lot of this money.
Mm.
Because as we know, the state is now a hungry beast that's eating its head off at our expense.
See, this has always been the issue. When Napoleon described us as a nation of shopkeepers, I always regarded that as possibly the highest compliment.
Indeed.
What he's suggesting is a nation of self-made, self-directing men who are competent and capable of running their own businesses, running their own lives. And this is just one of the... This is why I say to people... If you want self-direction, being a tradesman is a pretty much a guaranteed way for your entire life that you'll have independence.
But don't you think, again, that vast number of people who run their own businesses, I think Emily Thornberry called them sort of people with England flags outside
yes,
their houses.
That's,
I
mean, that's
these,
me,
these,
yes.
These to me are the backbone of Britain. And shouldn't we make their life easier?
Yes.
Shouldn't we get rid of all this IR35 nonsense?
Yes.
Shouldn't we actually encourage them to become individuals who trade in their own name, become principals, not agents, become proud stakeholders of Britain?
Well,
not sort of what I call, either statist or corporatist liggers, as I call them, which is what happens when you get big companies. Again, big companies, the big corporates are just as bad as big government, really.
Oh, yes. But so,
and what are they, Carl? What are they? I'll tell you what they are. They've been formed on the back of the pensions of the baby boomers. So again, as the baby boomers require that money, some of these companies aren't going to be quite as secure as they were before. So things are going to change naturally, I think. Mm.
But have you considered that a nation of independent, smart, and free-minded people don't grow a bureaucracy?
They don't want one.
I know.
Why should they fund one?
Yeah, precisely. They don't work very well for the internationalist corporate global agenda.
No.
Do they?
No.
And I think really that's the ultimate issue, isn't it?
Come back to why can't we have a group of competing of cooperating nation states? That's got to be with accountable parliaments.
Yes.
And high-minded individuals who run their own businesses who demand of those people running the country. We haven't got that.
I agree. Rupert, this has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure. I'm delighted. I'll come in anytime.
Oh, brilliant. We'll definitely have you back. Thanks for joining us, folks. We'll see
pleasure.
You next time.
Hey, it's Cole Swindell, and when I spend 200 days a year rolling down the highway, the bus can start to feel smaller than a guitar case. Everyone wonders how I stay chill while the hours crawl by. Truth is, one good luck spent on Chumba, and suddenly the trip feels a whole lot shorter. Finding your space, even when there isn't much to spare. Need some chill? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNCs apply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.